the greatest thing to me that I love is hearing the way that you honor the artist that you have on.
Stories make the world go round. They capture our minds, pull at our hearts, and inspire change, growth, and development.
It's just your genuine human appreciation on a deep, like, soul level for what artists do. This, your podcast is really dope.
I'm your host, Cello, and welcome to Bedroom Beethoven's, the podcast where we discover some of the preeminent music producers and entertainers of our time, and I turn them into storytellers.
What's up? This is J-Rock, and I'm right here. I'm chilling on the Bedroom Beethoven's podcast. That's what it is. Let's go.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 180 of the podcast. Follow me as we head up north to the Steel City of Pittsburgh. My guest this week is...
I'm Edan, the founder and owner of ID Labs recording studio in Pittsburgh, PA. I mix, produce, and record most notably with Mac Miller and Wiz Khalifa, but lots of other people too.
Without getting too melodramatic, it's an absolute honor that I get to talk to you, especially on Mac Miller's birthday.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, yeah. It sure is. Rest in peace to the homie.
Rack out the rack, I got the sack, keep the buffets, pack out the pack, stay with the Nina, two cups and a zip, juicy don't fight, I just entered the clips, blowing my cash, high off the gas, pay 20 stacks and they run up and blast, next thing you see him, his face on the shirt, next car he riding, stretch limo hurt, see why you niggas mad, nigga, that too mean, you show cash, nigga, stuffed in the Louis bag, nigga, juicy JB dad, nigga, big bag of that stank killer, codeine in my drink killer, most niggas be lying, say they is, but they ain't killers, nigga wanna play with me, I'ma break them off. My youngest, they'll do it. I'ma bring them off. They'll get on your ass, then they fly and take it off. Nigga, we gon' take a life before we take a loss.
I sit down with the great and powerful Edan to discuss his upbringing, navigating through strict flow, day jobs at Olive Garden, finding success with Wiz and Mac, and all landing on current and future projects. And in 2023, there are no signs of slowing down. And I'm honored to bring forth this conversation as I hit a new set of tens, episode 180 of the Bedroom Beethoven's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, thank you to everyone that listens, lets me know how much the podcast means to them, lets me know it should be bigger. And the best way you can do that is to just tell a friend, like, comment, subscribe, get the word out, all that good stuff. If you enjoy these conversations, it's just a small way to give back and something I don't take lightly. I appreciate everyone's time and attention. Last thing, if you want to keep the podcast ad-free and show some love, I set up a website apart from bedroombeethovens.com, which you can find at patreon.com. That's patreon.com/bedroombeethovens, where you can give a few bucks to gain early access to podcast episodes and a few other perks. There's merch and stickers, and we can chat and all that good stuff. It's just a small community over there that I'm proud to be a part of. And as we set off into the new year, I just want to remind everyone that you're amazing, you're needed, and appreciated. Let's make 2023 a good one. Without further ado, here is my conversation with ID Lab's own, Taylor Gang's own, Edan. How do your kids react to someone like you as their dad, like who's attending Grammy Awards with their mom, or, you know, having Ariana Grande in the studio, or Mac Miller stopping by the house on Christmas morning, and a thousand other unique situations like that?
I'm still dad. I'm still only half cool most days. I don't think they really, you know, had a full appreciation of, you know, the people I was working with or the things I was doing until, you know, more recent years. So my oldest is 19 now, my youngest is 17. I think that growing up, it was just sort of, you know, a normal thing that I did what I did, and they didn't think much about it. And as they got older, they were like, "Hey, Dad, I saw this YouTube video that you did years ago that, you know, has all these views, and I didn't know that you did this song with this person," and, you know, that kind of stuff. So that's pretty cool. And they both got great music taste. So I'm really proud of that.
Yeah. People always talk about like the producer artist relationship, but like, you know, sometimes I think about like, I wonder what Timbaland means to Genuine's kids, you know, like what kind of relationship do they have? It's unique, you know?
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I mean, it's cool. It's, I feel like, you know, I've managed to somehow build a legacy that they can look at and say, you know, hey, my dad did all this stuff that, you know, is still around, and still there's people that, you know, listen to it and are maybe inspired by it and that sort of thing. So it's nice to see them, really, you know, come into some appreciation for that, or just understanding of, you know, how sort of unlikely it was for that to happen, you know, particularly coming out of Pittsburgh.
Yeah. It's interesting you touched on that. Like, so, you know, both your sons are like college age, and it costs, you know, I don't know, $45,000 to go to Berklee College, as an undergrad per year. And if you stay at the dorms, oh, that's another $25,000. Right. Or you can be like Edan and read manuals and tinker around and connect the dots and do it yourself, you know? Right. So, you know, you've had dumb luck, you've gamed the system, and of course with tenacity and talent, you've arrived at the point where even if you went to college now, it wouldn't do much in your career. So if your kids look at that example and say, "Nah, Dad, I'm not trying to waste $60,000 a year on college," I mean, you didn't, and look at you. You know, what are your expectations and feelings about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question that I feel like we're grappling with now. My oldest is going to school for physician's assistant. And I'm really happy that he's, you know, going into just such like an in-demand field. But, you know, he's also started tinkering around with making beats. And, you know, he's just like a huge fan of music and completely shares my music taste almost exactly. You know, I would never discourage either one of them from pursuing anything that they love. I mean, if nothing else, that's what, you know, this has afforded me and us as a family is, you know, the ability to let them explore things that interest them and that they might be passionate about. But at the same time, I know, you know, how incredibly lucky I've been in this business. And I think the one thing that always pops out at me when I think about this is that if I was being real with them and they really wanted to get into music, you know, my first piece of advice would have to be, you got to get out of Pittsburgh, you know, and you can't expect what happened for me, you know, to be a likely scenario to happen for you or anyone else, because it is really unlikely at the end of the day. And, you know, I just wouldn't want to see them move. So, you know, as far as school versus not, it obviously just depends, you know, what you're trying to do. And, you know, for me, it just didn't click. I was just, you know, too passionate about music and too into what I was doing outside of school. I mean, I went to college for a little while, but I just never felt like, you know, I was there for the right reasons, and I never felt like I was really taking it, you know, as seriously as I should have, because I was so distracted by music, you know, and it was just like always my focus. So it is hard to say to them like, yeah, you know, I know school's hard, but it's worth it. And you know, when they can definitely look at me and say, you know, hey, look at all the stuff you did without school. But, you know, it just depends what you want to do. And obviously, if you want to get into the medical field, you got to go to school. If, you know, you want to do something in the entertainment business, you don't necessarily have to go to school. But you have to accept the fact that, you know, your schooling might be, you know, more fraught and more difficult than actual school. And it's anybody's guess what the right path is, because, you know, it's more so about the people you meet and the situations that you fall into, and just your overall sort of work ethic and attitude towards what you're doing, that are more important when you're, you know, following a career path that doesn't have to entail some sort of formal training. But all those options are open for them. I think they've probably heard me complain about the music business so much that, you know, even if they wanted to get into it, they might be afraid to tell me. but I've tried to leave the door open, and I've always said to them, hey, you know, do what interests you first. Don't get into something because you feel like it's going to be cool, or because it's going to be lucrative, or, you know, whatever. Make it something that you're passionate about and something that genuinely interests you, because I think that's the only way, you know, to really get to a point in life where you're content and satisfied with what you do is, you know, if it's something that's infinitely interesting to you, then, you know, it's always going to be, and you can always get something out of it, you know, as opposed to just a paycheck.
So, I mean, looking back at this journey, like how does that start with like a neighborhood babysitter? You know, how does that experience ultimately lead to, I don't know, 30 years later, now we're listening to Juicy J music?
Yeah, wow, you definitely did some research. If you know about the babysitter, that was, yeah, there was a lady across the street that was our friend's grandmother. And, you know, both my parents worked, so we would stay with her most days, and she was just a self-taught pianist. And, you know, she would play church songs, Christmas songs. You know, she didn't, I don't think she read music, but she would just sit down at the piano and play. And I would just sit on the bench next to her and watch her. And it just, I think really early on, I mean, it was probably, you know, 5-6 years old or something like that, watching this. And I just thought it was the most amazing thing in the world that someone could, you know, sit at this box and make these sounds and, you know, play these songs just, you know, from memory and by ear, you know, with no sheet music in front of them. And yeah, I think that definitely put an early seed into my brain that, you know, this is something that I really enjoy, or you know, something that I'm really into.
Yeah, I'm being fascinated with kind of the origins of how people get that seed of creativity and then kind of where they end up. Like Masai Turner has a master's degree and works in education now, and then there's Chad Glick, who used to manage, you know, Wiz. And then as time went on, I see that he shows up less and less in music, and now he has a dog care facility.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's just like, where the people of your past have pivoted and transitioned out of music, how are you able to stay in it and become even bigger and more demand in your field?
I'm just persistent. You know, like if it's something that I want to do, if it's something that interests me, or, you know, something I want to accomplish, I've never been afraid of the work, you know, and not to say that any of those guys were, but I spent a lot of time, you know, just burying myself in piles of records and, you know, sit in front of an MPC. And that was really all I did. And I didn't, you know, I didn't go out. Like, I didn't do a lot outside of my basement. You know, I just was obsessed. I think those guys had other interests, you know, outside of the basement studio, and you know, life just took them in other directions. But I just always had this like supreme focus. I mean, Masai was definitely sort of the leader of our little group, you know, and he was for sure determined. And, you know, he probably was the first person that really like showed me how motivated you can really be, you know, especially with this music shit, just watching his example of like, you know, we're going to do this no matter what. And in any way possible, you know, we're going to try to stick our foot in the door. It was sort of like, okay, like, you know, this is how you do it. Like, you just, you look for, you know, every opening you can, and you try to be as good as you can. And when the group fell apart, you know, I think that it just so happened that I was sort of the only person that, that had, you know, a skill that, that could keep me in music, you know, and make me a living without having to sort of quote unquote make it, you know, which was just, I had started recording us, you know, I was already recording other people in the city, you know, just having learned trial by fire with us as a group. So when we broke up, you know, it just was sort of already in motion with the studio. And that wasn't something that those guys, you know, knew how to do or were necessarily into. So they just sort of went their separate ways and ended up where they ended up. And I just kept going.
Population changing their frequency modulation. Tune in 247 on any and all occasion. The flow style highly requested, heavy rotation, ready your station. We bringing it live to every location. The world population changing their frequency modulation.
That goal where you've only ever wanted to do what music was just sit in a room all day, make it and earn a living. Is that goal ever achieved? Like, perhaps once you're able to make a living from music, do you move the goalpost and say, okay, well, now I'm going to buy a house for my mom. Okay, now if I can put my kids through college. Okay, now if I can win 5 Grammys. You know, or is that the core philosophy that, that is important to keep?
I mean, it'd be disingenuous to say that money, you know, hasn't been part of my thinking. My musical journey started, you know, maybe when I was 16 and started playing guitar, but my musical career really, to me, didn't start until I opened the studio, you know, and that didn't happen until my late 20s. And, you know, I had a kid on the way, and that was such a big weight on me that, you know, at the time it definitely was at the forefront, was like, you know, all right, I got to make a living, but I got to do this because this is what I do. Money was definitely the motivator in terms of like, you know, this is what I want to do. Like, I want to sit in a room and make music all day, and whatever allows me to do that and support my family at the same time, you know, that's how I'm going to approach this, you know, which is what led me to recording, you know, 50 different people every week and, you know, spending nights in the studio doing music I didn't necessarily enjoy, but to me, I was still doing music. I was still following my path, but I was making a living, you know, the best way that I knew how to.
Well, so you say that like you're playing guitar at 16, and I know you're making beats on the side, but let's say your friends are like, hey, your beats suck. Would you have been like, well, my dreams of being like a Costello or a Jeff Beck or a Hendrix, let's see how far this guitar can take me. Maybe you would have excelled in a punk band. Who knows? But was it like the acceptance of your peers and maybe the rap influence of Pittsburgh that pulled you towards rap, or how did that go? How did that sway in that direction?
I don't know. And actually that's something I always wonder, because, you know, I went to this like tiny little Catholic school growing up. Definitely wasn't a lot of people listening to rap. Probably just, you know, discovered it via MTV like everyone else. But it's at some point in like 7th grade, maybe, it like popped onto my radar, and I just, you know, became like obsessed with it. I mean, to the point where I remember in 8th grade, somebody's parents had like a video camera that we set up in the backyard, and I, out of cardboard and masking tape, I built these boxes that looked like turntables, and I cut a piece of wood into a circle and put a chain on it and drew the Public Enemy symbol, you know, the guy in the crosshairs, and hung it around my neck and convinced some friends of mine, you know, to like, let's make this video to this Public Enemy song, you know, and I'm going to be Terminator X and you guys can be, you know, Flav and Chuck D. And I wish that tape still existed, you know, I just was that obsessed with it. And then I had a paper route at the time. So, you know, I would just take all my paper money and buy tapes, you know, whenever I could. And that was sort of my thing, you know, up until 16, I discovered Hendrix basically. And that sort of pulled me right out of hip hop, you know, and I just became so obsessed with Jimmy and guitar. And so I spent the next, you know, 3-4 years just like totally into that. Sort of fell away from hip hop. Never hated it or anything. I just like kind of stopped following it because I got, you know, so into guitar. And then at some point, probably around the time like Wu-Tang came out, I started, you know, hearing things that were like just different, you know, from what I had heard before in rap. And it just sort of like pulled me back in. And that was, you know, when I started like messing around with it. I, you know, somehow came up on a little like drum machine, like this Boss drum machine. I don't even remember exactly how I got it, but, you know, it was just like a cheap little thing. And there was a music store near me that would rent gear. So they rented cassette 4-tracks for like $25 a month or $50 a month or something like that. So I went and rented one, you know, just so I could like lay this drum pattern down and then, you know, start playing things on top of it. And at the time, like I didn't have any way to, you know, sample anything. So I wasn't sampling. The only thing I could do was, you know, play stuff over these drum beats I was making on this drum machine. So that was what I did, you know, for like a couple of years. And someone gave me like their, you know, little console piano, digital home piano thing. And I added that to the mix. So I was just doing stuff that way. So I came into hip hop, you know, just in this weird way. And it's, you know, it's funny because I really study like my favorite producers, you know, the premieres and Pete Rocks and like people from, you know, the late 80s, early 90s era. And the way all those guys got into it was, you know, their parents' record collection and DJing. My entry point was just so different, and probably because of, you know, where I grew up and the kids that I grew up around. And I always felt like I was the person, you know, feeding hip hop to people. Whereas it wasn't, you know, most of the kids that I knew weren't as into it at first, until I was like, oh man, you gotta check out this Run DMC song and, you know, or whatever. So yeah, it was just like a totally different entry point for me, but that was sort of how it went.
Yeah. Cause in your area, you're probably getting, you know, employee discounts at pianos and stuff, or, you know, discounted guitars or something.
Yeah. That was much later. I mean, you know, at some point, you know, I had like 100 jobs, you know, from KFC to the Olive Garden, whatever, you know, all these places. But, you know, I eventually got this job at pianos and stuff, a music store near me. And that was a big come up. I mean, I basically was just working for gear. It paid terribly, but it was, you know, I'd take my paycheck and I'd set, you know, exactly what I needed aside for living expenses. And I'd pretty much just hand the rest back to the owner. And he would sell me gear, like, you know, a dealer costs. I would get it fairly cheap, you know, but it was still expensive. And, I just started, you know, amassing as much as I could, which didn't amount to much, but it was eventually like a mic preamp and a microphone and an MPC, you know, and a little mixer and some speakers. By that point I was already both feet into beats, but yeah, that was a huge come up for me. I still have some of that gear. I still use some of that gear.
Yeah. you mentioned, I guess Wu-Tang, I guess since that was like such a good entry point, it's no wonder. Cause I think you had, Only Built for Cuban Links on the walls of the first iteration of ID Lab. So that, I guess that explains that.
Yeah, definitely. Although I wouldn't say that like they were the top thing for me. I think it was just that era where things started getting a little grittier again, you know, just the rawness of what they were doing, you know, especially because like I had been into rock for a while, you know, and I'd really gone into like classic rock and alternative rock and stuff. And I needed, you know, something edgier. And the stuff that those guys were doing and other guys were doing, you know, it gave me that energy and was just sort of a way for me to get back to hip hop.
Well, I think a good way to work seamlessly on other genres is to be a mixer, which is who you are. I remember, I think on Twitter, you might have asked Alchemist who his mixer was. I think it was on a Boldy James or a Freddie Gibbs record. I think one of their songs piqued your interest. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, no, it was actually a record he did with Schoolboy Q.
Schoolboy Q, yeah, and I think Eddie Sancho, I think, that did that. And the thing about Eddie Sancho that I noticed is that he will mix for Nas, Jay-Z, Snoop Dogg, Eminem, which is fantastic, mm-hmm. but he's also mixing for Janet Jackson and Limp Bizkit. You know, as a mixer, like you have an ear for rock, you have an ear for hip hop. To be able to mix a rock album, an R&B album, and hip hop albums, is that hard to do?
It's definitely a different mindset, you know, going into it because you're looking for different things to poke out of the record, you know. And I mean, I don't mix a whole ton of rock records, but you know, when I do, it's obviously less emphasis on drums and lead vocal, whereas, you know, when I'm mixing a hip hop record, it's like that's the things that always, you know, are in front. I mean, these days it's 808 a lot too in front, but I think just as like a fan of music, you know, and as a mixer, you're just when you're, you know, pulling up raw tracks to mix and you're listening to the demo, you know, as a guide, you're just hearing music, you know, and if you appreciate music, then, you know, your mind is telling you how you want it to hear and you start moving in that direction, you know, both consciously and unconsciously. It's not totally different, I guess, in terms of, you know, I just want it to sound right and I just want it to sound pleasing, you know, to the ear sonically, but tell the story. You know, all music is sort of the same in that way. But yeah, definitely, you know, from a technical standpoint, you make some different moves, you know, depending on the genre. And mostly it just comes down to balances, you know, like what's in front and how in front is it, you know, as opposed to other elements. And that'll vary from genre to genre. But again, it's all feel. I mean, I don't do a lot of referencing or anything. You just listen to it and it'll tell you what to do. If you're paying attention.
Like right now, if Paramore said, "Edan, please mix our new record," would that be something you'd be excited mm-hmm. about?
Oh, hell yeah. I love them. I don't know if I'd be the guy, but I'd sure enjoy trying, you know. Their records sound amazing too.
That's the thing. Like I'm completely naive when it comes to these kind of things, but I know every time that Rick mm-hmm. Rubin mixes a rock album like Slipknot or Metallica, yeah. it's shit, man. It's so harsh. Right. And the mastering is always like really flat. And I just... like this dude is like hailed as a guru, right. but when it comes to rock music, he's not good at mixing rock. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, he's not actually, I mean, he doesn't actually mix. I mean, he has engineers that he works with, but he definitely steers stuff in that direction. I mean, I think Rick's thing is, you know, he's just got this kind of stripped down, everything in your face sort of approach. And I really enjoy his records, you know, rock and otherwise. But there's definitely some that get criticized. I mean, I think most of those, you know, were caught up in the early, you know, or mid 2000s sort of, well, I guess early 2000s, it started like the loudness wars. And, you know, once CDs became popular and everyone's goal became, you know, make it louder than the next record, you know, a lot of his seminal stuff came out in that era. And I mean, especially the rock stuff. So I think part of it was just sort of like you had to have a certain level of volume. And when you're going for that level of volume, you know, if your mix is already centered in the mid-range and focused on vocals and drums, and there's already an inherent dryness to it and lack of ambience, then I think that's what you end up with, you know, when all of those things combined is, you know, sort of an abrasive record that's not, you know, not sort of padded around it by ambience and reverb and, you know, this wash of instruments. Rick's thing to me is like everything is very intentional and in focus, but, you know, when you take a mix like that and try to make it as loud as possible, then yeah, I think things can start getting harsh. Is what was happening.
It's funny you said that. Like you say, it's intentional. So I guess that's just his style. But maybe there is also some self awareness. Like what you just said, you understand what is good and what is bad. Maybe that's what makes Dave Pensado or Tony Maserati or yourself, self aware of stuff like that.
I mean, I think those guys definitely come from a different perspective. You know, like they're doing a lot of pop R&B records, where this, you know, sort of lushness is the goal, and that's probably inherent to their sound as well, you know, just as who they are and how they hear music. You know, I think that's just naturally the direction guys like that go in. And again, with, you know, with Rick, it's like the thing is always like, at least, you know, from what I hear or notice about his productions is, you know, there's just not a lot of like filler. You're not going to hear a Rick Rubin track or a track that Rick Rubin produced that's got, you know, stacks and stacks of background vocals and, you know, lush pads happening everywhere and stuff. And which would be the kind of stuff that maybe, you know, Dave Pensado is getting, or, you know, or Tony Maserati or whoever it might be. You know, with Rick, I always feel like, you know, his goal is just to strip away everything that's not important to the record and to the song. Not to say that, you know, vocal stacks and things aren't important, but it's, again, sort of genre specific, because if you're mixing R&B records in the 2000s, you know, there's going to be 60 tracks of double, triple, quadrupled vocals everywhere. So you got to approach that differently.
But you made a beat like, you know, The Race for Wiz Khalifa, where you completed that beat on the spot. So there wasn't a lot of stripping away, adding stuff. Like, you know, you're an artist, so you're okay, this beat is finished and it ends up being an instant classic. Is that a rare occurrence? Do you usually like let it sit and then you go back?
Yeah, you know what? I almost always, even with The Race, I mean, there was all of those records on Rolling Papers. I mean, there was the initial putting it together. And then there was, you know, a period after that where, you know, I would arrange things a little bit better and, you know, maybe add a melody here or something, you know, to fill certain parts. I definitely don't work fast. It bugs me out, you know, when I see young kids and how fast they are able to work. Like, I don't think my brain works that way. It's like, I really need to, stew on things a little bit and, you know, just sort of take my time with things and gain different perspectives before I'm like, okay, I think this is done, you know, which isn't all. I mean, occasionally, like, it'll just sort of happen, you know. I mean, I think, like, I don't know, Frick Park Market is one, like a lot of stuff with Mac. I mean, there's been both things have gone on, like, been plenty of records that we, you know, made on the spot, but then continued to add to for weeks or months. But there's a couple, I think Party on Fifth Ave, maybe. No, I think I added some of the stuff for the bridge later on. I mean, you know, regardless of any of that, it's, you know, it's still the best way to work as far as I'm concerned, like getting in a room with somebody and creating something from scratch. You end up with something more special a lot of times than if, you know, you're sort of in separate places and maybe on different wavelengths and you're sending stuff back and forth or whatever. But it's harder to do now because really, you know, the way that technology has grown in the creation of music, it's led to a place where, you know, things are fast. It's easy to get to a certain point. I mean, in seconds, you know, you can have something happening beat wise And I think that's led to a lack of patience, you know, with artists and even producers themselves, where if something's not happening immediately, it's like, you know, on to the next. I can sit with a beat up, you know, half the day and just be listening to it and thinking of parts and, you know, changing things in the arrangement or changing a drum sound or whatever. That's a more comfortable way for me to work. And it's also because I enjoy that that process, that, you know, that part of things, like just the energy of creating something new. That's the best part for me. So I'm usually not in a hurry, you know, to call it finished. And a lot of times just have to stop myself and say, okay, especially in recent years, you know, because I feel like back then, like, you know, in those days, like when I made The Race, you know, I don't know if I'd make a beat that's so, you know, full of layers and parts now, because I, you know, to my sort of current mind and ear, it feels a little crowded, you know, and it worked for the vibe, but even that record, like I can listen to and be like, I probably didn't need that extra, you know, synth pad there. Like it really just, you know, is maybe obscuring like something else going on that was cool.
Well, let me ask you from a human nature perspective, maybe ego. Like, I don't know if this is bittersweet for you, but it was like you did This Plane or The Race, but from a top 40 radio level, that wasn't the song that put him on the map. It was Black and Yellow, which was a song you didn't produce. So for that to be the catalyst to get him on mainstream, like, I would have liked that to have been like the guy that was there from the very beginning, like that journey. Was that like kind of a bittersweet, like, I really wish I would have did that, or he picked my song?
Sure. I mean, you know, you always want to be the guy that, you know, was the hero and made, like, you know, the record. But I've come to sort of like accept and be totally cool with the fact that, like, I'm not a hit maker, you know, like if you want a hit record, at least in that era, you know, you're going to call Stargate, you're going to call Benny Blanco or Jim Johnson or whoever. I'm the guy that, you know, is going to make, or so it ended up, the guy that's going to make like what might be the hardcore fan's favorite track from the album, you know, but not necessarily the radio song. I've always had this weird adversity to, like, you know, very popular music. And a lot of it is just like the music nerd in me. I love discovering music, you know, and I love discovering music that is, you know, obscure or people haven't heard or I haven't, you know, been aware of. I mean, music in general to me is, you know, it is discovery, like the creation of music and, you know, discovering something in yourself, or just, you know, discovering a way to put something together. And that carries to, you know, the way I listen to music. And I don't really think in terms of like, this is going to be something that 100 million people like, you know, I try to think in terms of like, this is unique or different and this isn't something I've done before or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, you know, you always want to be that guy, but you ultimately just have to be, you know, who you are. And I've come to accept the fact that, you know, particularly with Wiz, you know, I'm not going to be the singles guy. Like there's other people that are just going to be better at making singles for what works for him.
But he's like, so on The Race, he's also like, you know, it's not, let's say it's not like, this isn't going to be the single, but I mean, he's coming out of his comfort zone and he's singing on the record. Mm-hmm. Is that attributed to you? Do you have to pull
right
that element out of him, because you know you want music to be self-discovering, like, oh, I didn't know Wiz could sing, and he's doing it more on your tracks.
He was already doing a lot of that, you know, to me, like when we were doing, like, you know, Flight School or Star Power, like, you know, these really old mixtapes, like, you know, there was a ton of singing on those. Even Prince of the City too, you know what I mean? Like something like Who I Am that Sledren did, you know, he's singing the whole track. So like, I knew that was, you know, part of him already. You know, I don't think that we sat down with the intention of like, hey, let's make this like, you know, sort of, you know, spacey, melodic thing. It was just like, that's what we were feeling, you know, and I've always tended to be like a little bit more melodic with beats, you know, and less about like, you know, less about raw energy, you know, or even catchy melodies necessarily. And, you know, more about something that like envelopes you a bit, you know, and just is like a vibey sort of feel to it. So I think that was just like a natural thing, you know. I mean, I definitely, you know, except for the very, very early days of working with Wiz, like, you know, I never really tried to steer him in a particular direction.
I guess, you know, if you're all about ego, that would be a nightmare situation in the studio, but I guess you're able to be more trusting and let Wiz have autonomy and do the thing that he wants to do. And then when it comes out, it ends up being a hit because you trusted the process.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, I honestly don't feel like I've ever had much of an ego with, in terms of being a producer and my accomplishments or, you know, how I felt about myself. Like, I've just always felt like a student, you know, of the music. And I've always felt like I'm, you know, even now still trying to get to the place where, you know, I can do exactly what I'm hearing in my head. But with Wiz, you know, we started working together so early in his, you know, his journey, like, you know, he was 16. I had the studio and, you know, it had sort of had its name already in the city. And I think that he came into the situation looking up to me, just as like a mentor sort of, you know, at least when we made the decision to start working together. So there was that trust, you know, sort of built in that, you know, well, this guy's got this studio and he's, you know, he's doing all this stuff. So he must know what he's talking about, you know? And I probably didn't, but they, you know, he gave me that sort of trust. And then, you know, I think as the years went on, you know, especially by the time we got to Kush and OJ, you know, he was just finding his voice. And I didn't know what his voice was at the time. You know, we had done a lot of projects already together at that point. You know, there was a lot of like, at least for me, you know, maybe not for him, but for me, there was a lot of frustration, you know, with things not turning out the way that we would hope, you know, with Warner Brothers and just, you know, in general. So, you know, I think when Kush and OJ came around, I was like kind of fighting my own nature and was feeling like, nah, man, like, you know, we need to make some records that are really going to hit, you know, commercially, like that, you know, that have a wider appeal to them. And I felt like Kush and Orange Juice was this really unique thing. And it took, you know, halfway through that project to really like grasp it, you know, to hear all these songs that he had made, you know, once it started getting to a certain point, it was like the light bulb, you know, sort of went off and was like, yo, he's creating his own lane. We don't need to put ourselves in the same place as everyone else. Like, he's making his sound now, and all the other stuff before that, you know, was just sort of like training to get to this point. And, you know, it was hard for me to understand that at first, because it was like, you know, it's just another day in the studio. We're just working on another song. So I didn't see the shift, you know, and until it had already started happening. And, you know, there was enough of that body of work together that it could click in my mind as like, oh, this now he is on his sound. You know, this is who he is as an artist and as a rapper. Everything else was, you know, was him just trying on different coats, you know, to see what looked good. And this is the one where he finally found, you know, the coat that fit him best. And then once I realized that, it was like, okay, you know, this is something special. But that was me trusting him. Not that he would have cared if I did or not, but in that moment, my internal conversation was like, he's got this, you know, like I got to trust his vision with this because I didn't see this, you know, like I didn't see that this was the way that he needed to go, and he figured it out. So I just gave into it at that point and was like, you know, this is it.
So you find a lot of success and Wiz goes to LA, and I hope I'm not taking your quote out of context, but you said you felt bored and deflated. How do you get your mojo back in that scenario?
I think I felt, I mean, pre Rolling Papers, you know, I just felt deflated in the way that I felt like, all right, you know, I just was here to help lay the groundwork, and, you know, now this is going to be a thing without me. I didn't have any real reason to feel that way other than, like, you know, he just wasn't around anymore because, you know, he had gotten momentum and he was, you know, doing shows and he was out of town. So I just felt like, you know, maybe this is just going to be a thing that just sort of goes on without me. And that'll be my story, is like, I was there to help, you know, build it somewhat. And so the boredom was just, you know, not having any particular artist or project at the time that I was, like, you know, fully invested with. Cause I, you know, I don't always necessarily enjoy, like, just sitting around making beats just for the sake of it, you know, like it's much more rewarding to be making beats and have an artist next to you and have the instant gratification of writing a song together. So, you know, that didn't change until, you know, Wiz made it very clear that, you know, he wanted me and Germ and Sledger and everybody, you know, that had worked with him in Pittsburgh to be a part of things, which he did.
You know? Well, before we wrap up, do you mind if I ask you a few questions pertaining to Mac Miller?
No, of course not.
His last album was completed by John Bryan, who you've said in the past that when working with Mac Miller, you know there's no finished project in the archives that you knew he was cool with. And his family said, nope, it's okay. You have the green light to finish this project. Mac didn't. So I guess, you know, this might be just a long-winded way to say, are you happy with Circles being the final chapter of his legacy, or would you have preferred that nothing came out?
No, I absolutely am. You know, I love that record, and I'm glad it came out. And I think that the only person on the planet that could have finished it in a way that Mac would be proud was John Bryan. You know, he did things on that record that I feel sure Mac would have appreciated that I know that I wasn't capable of doing. There was no better person. And you know, a lot of those were started with John. So it just made sense to continue with him. But I think that it was important. You know, I know that, you know, Mac was really excited about those records when he was making them, you know, making the demos. And, you know, he definitely felt like, you know, hey, this is going to be my next chapter. You know, I might go back to just straight rapping, I might whatever, but, you know, this very next chapter, this is going to be me exploring this more songwriter, singer-songwriter sort of, like, you know, something beyond hip-hop idea. I think that it would have been really important for him to see that released, you know, and to see people appreciate that side of him. And yeah, again, like, I don't think that there was anyone better than John. I mean, you got to keep in mind too, like, you know, Mac was such a big fan of John, and, like, you know, the Eternal Sunshine soundtrack was, like, one of his favorite pieces of music. And, you know, he had such appreciation for what that guy did and does as a musician and as a producer and composer. So, you know, I think all the way around it was the right call, and I'm glad it, you know, exists in the world.
Well, I actually have a Mac Miller story for you. I was the art director at the Formula One racetrack out in Texas, at Circuit of the Americas, from 2012 to 2015. And Wiz Khalifa would always play at the 360 Amphitheater out there with like Fall Out Boy. I think it was like the Boys of Summer tour and stuff. Mm-hmm. And as the track gained popularity, we actually won the bid for the X Games. And this was the summer of 14. It was 9 years ago. And headlining was Kanye West and the Flaming Lips. And the second billing was Gary Clark Jr. and Slightly Stupid. And then the third billing all the way at the bottom was Mac Miller. And I remember designing the flyer. Like, you know, I know who Mac Miller is. I didn't really listen to Watching Movies with the Sound Off, but I did love Best Day Ever mixtape a whole lot. So going into the event, I didn't pay any mind because, you know, it was all about Kanye West. And let me tell you, he was cuckoo then too. He wouldn't allow his head on any of the publicity shots. He wore like a chain link helmet and he wouldn't let anyone see his face. But that's another story. But let me tell you, the day of, everyone went bonkers for Mac Miller. I was like, oh, there is a shift in energy in this whole place. I thought everybody was going to go cuckoo for Kanye,
right?
But Mac gave the best performance, and I can honestly say the crowd went the craziest for him. And this was 14. This was 9 years ago.
Yeah, man. Like, you know, watching Wiz's rise to fame, you know, was this slow burn, you know, where we toiled and toiled for years, and then, you know, things slowly, you know, you'd get to this level, and then you'd, you know, where there's people coming to the shows, and you get to this level where it's like, oh, we popped up on the iTunes chart, you know. With Mac, it was like, you know, it just exploded, you know, from almost the very start. And it felt like overnight, you know, everything just happened all at once. And it was really wild to just like, you know, to have been through the situation with Wiz and to watch him, you know, sort of like just fight his way to this place. And then with Mac, for it to just like happen so quickly and effortlessly, it felt like that was just a really wild experience. And his shows are legendary.
Do you think you have it in you to take like another Jermaine Dupri Bow Wow situation, like take a 15, 16 year old and build them up into? Do you have that in you anymore? Or is that just, man, like lightning in a bottle hit a couple times and I think it's over?
I never expect it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I, you know, for it to have happened twice for me already is pretty crazy. So it would be, you know, really out of this world for it to happen again. But I would definitely put myself in the position if the right artist, you know, came my way. And a lot of it for me is just like, you know, how I relate to a person and how able we are to work together, in that way, because everything's so different now, you know, like people can really sort of like get a buzz going completely 100% by themselves. And I think that that's sort of pushed to people, like that's the way to do it. So you don't see a lot of artists like just sort of like setting up shop with a particular producer, you know, even early on. Just doesn't seem to be the way things happen now. I'm sure there's notable exceptions, but definitely, you know, that's something I would love to do. If it was, you know, if the right person came into view that was like making music that really spoke to me, and they were somebody that I could, you know, be in a room with and enjoy their company, then, you know, 100% I would jump into the situation and put everything I had into it. But, you know, it's not like I'm out there necessarily actively looking. I'm always sort of paying attention, but, you know, I'm not really like searching for it.
Yeah, I think that has to be organic or it's not going to work. You definitely can't force that.
Yeah, it does. I mean, you know, like Mac and Wiz, like, I mean, it's just two kids that literally just walked into the studio one day, you know, with no expectations whatsoever. So, you know, I think that is how those situations come about. You know, they just sort of happened because the universe allowed them to happen. And you can't really like force them. And I felt myself forcing it a little bit, you know, maybe, I don't know, 5-6 years ago or something. It was like, I felt like I want to find another artist, you know, and I would sort of go on these like quests, you know, locally and via the internet, whatever. And those things just never seemed to work out, you know. Maybe I just wasn't finding the right people. Maybe it just wasn't, you know, a genuine enough scenario in terms of like it just sort of happening in a certain way, and you know, it was me trying to not necessarily recreate what happened with Mac and Wiz, but you know, recreate that sort of relationship. And I think I just realized at some point, like, you know what, if it happens again, it happens again, but you know, maybe it's not even meant to, so maybe it won't, and that's okay.
Yeah, there's. I don't know if you know MTV giving you E-Dance Making the Band would pan out. You know.
Yeah, I don't know that. I don't know that it would either. It'd be fun to try, though. I would definitely try, but I'm not sure what happened.
Well, your solo work came out roughly about 18 months ago, and I'm sure you're staying busy. It's 2023, man. What can people expect from you? I want to give you the floor to tell people anything you want.
Well, I got a new album, instrumental album, that I've been sitting on for a little while, that will hopefully come out relatively soon, but I have no release date yet. Similar in vibe to the last one, but I feel like I took some of the concepts earlier. With the album I put out, you know, just sort of this collection of tracks that I would make them and feel like, hey, ain't nobody going to rap on this and put it aside, you know. And when I came up with the idea of like, hey, why don't I just do an instrumental album just for me, you know, for no other reason than I just want to finish these tracks and put it out. You know, that was the stuff I was drawing from. Whereas with the new one, it was a little bit more intent and insofar as I would start a beat, you know, or start a track and I would feel like, oh, this is something for me, you know, let me take it to that place where I'm not thinking about leaving room for a vocalist. I would just keep going with it. So I'm really excited about that. Other than that, you know, I'm just mixing records for any and everybody that I can. And still in Pittsburgh, keeping the studio going and trying to continue to build it into, you know, just a great place to be for local artists. And yeah, that's it.
Well, Edan, I didn't want to tell you this beforehand because I wanted to, I didn't want to like temper expectations, but to me, you're a top 15 producer of all time. If I had to make a list.
Thanks,
on man. A good day, that's, you might even crack my top 10.
That's that means a lot, man. It really does.
Some of the beats you made, they're definitely classic. So this was a real treat for me. And I also want to thank Will and Michelle for allowing me to do this. You have a lot of good people surrounding you, and
they're the best.
Yeah, and I get to talk to Big Germ next week, so I'm in good company, man.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
I'm very appreciative of the time that you let me borrow from you today. So
no, thanks so much, man. I appreciate you doing
happy
it.
Happy birthday, Mac Miller. Happy 20th anniversary to ID Labs. If my timeline's correct, I think we're celebrating 20 years. So.
We are, man. It's coming up this spring. So with any luck, I'll get my album out by then, but we'll see.
All right. Appreciate you, man. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, man. Take care.